Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Well, there's a little birdie that just flew in here and told me that there's an update.
Well, it's not exactly an update. As this last episode that we did, it really disturbed me to learn what we learned.
I don't even remember what we talked about last episode.
You need to refresh yourself during the week and listen to them. We talked about duty to protect.
Oh,
duty. That's right. We talked about duty to protect.
Let me just go ahead and throw it out there. I work on so much legal stuff during the week. I have no idea what we talked about the week before on our podcast for the most part.
What do you think? You're a lawyer or something?
My brain can only handle so much and it can't take much more.
Well, this thought about this in relation to what we were talking about last week, it just really disturbed me. And it brought a story to mind. There was a town that employs a guy.
Jack and the Beanstalk?
No, it wasn't Jack and the Beanstalk.
I'm just throwing it out there as a guess.
Nope, you were off. A town employs a guy to sit in a room all day and stand ready by a button on the wall. The button is designed to prevent a tragedy the town is aware of as a possibility. So all this guy does all day every day is sit and stare at this button. When or if the day comes that he is called by designated personnel and told to push the button, then he is to act and push the button. The guy goes to work for 30 years and stares at that button every day and nothing happens. Then one day, the call comes. The call from the designated personnel that says, push the button! Push the button now! The guy looks at the button and he thinks about it for a second. He decides that no one has ever told him exactly what will happen if he pushes a button. So out of fear or uncertainty, he doesn't push the button. The expected tragedy befalls the town. In the aftermath, people are screaming and mad and demanding from their leaders, why? Why did this happen? You said we had a button to push and this would not happen, or at least it would minimize the damage. Didn't you tell him to push the button? The people demanded that from their leaders. Yes. Yes, we did. Then what happened? Well, they explained, he chose not to. The crowd was outraged. He must pay, they shouted. He didn't do his job and now our lives are shattered. The crowd wanted him to pay with his life. Then the leader said to the crowd, he wasn't required to push the button. Silence fell over the crowd as they looked at each other in confusion. One mother who had lost her children in the tragedy stepped forward in the stunned crowd and she spoke. Why didn't he have to push it? She asked in disbelief. Well, it was his choice as to whether he pushed it or not. So, he didn't have to. Still not satisfied, the lone mother continued, but we all thought we were safe from this because of that button and the guy who vigilantly attended to it. If we had known, we maybe could have done something differently. We have been paying him for 30 years to be there just in case. What were we paying him for then? The leader looked out at the desperate crowd and he said, there was a chance that he might have pushed that button. There was a chance. And that's what we were left with our Parkland, Florida ruling. There was a chance that that guy might have done the right thing.
Yeah.
But he didn't. So all I'm saying is that we need to really think about if this is our line of defense for our children and there's only a chance that this guy might do something, is that good enough or should we be examining other things?
I getcha.
So that's my story for the day there, Mike.
You're saying there's a chance.
There's a chance, but that's all there is a chance.
I was thought there was going to be something profound that happened about that story.
No, it's just like in real life. There was nothing profound.
Why didn't he push the button?
Why didn't someone act when children were being slaughtered?
I don't know.
That's what I'm saying. We don't know. There's only a chance.
Well, today's episode is going to be about one of the most maligned topics in all of law school and lawyer talk, and is often a dreaded bar exam question, which I'm 99% sure that I got right on my bar exam. I don't know, because they don't actually give you the answers, but...
You don't get a grade?
You get a grade.
It's kind of a pass-fail?
No, you get a grade, a number grade, but they don't say, like, you missed this question, or you got this question right.
Well, they should, so you can correct it. Otherwise, you might practice law the rest of your life with the wrong information.
Well, I did explain to you the bar exam is based on common law, pretty much, which doesn't exist anywhere, so it doesn't really matter if you get it right or wrong. It's just that you understand the theory behind it.
Oh, and it's going to change state to state anyway, huh?
Exactly.
All right. Well, I'll let you slide then.
This topic that we're going to talk about today is called the rule against perpetuities.
Well, only reason I've heard of it is because we touched on it in another episode or so. So I kind of know of it, but I don't know about it. I did see that it is considered one of the hardest concepts for law students to conquer and pass on tests. So.
That is probably true. It strikes fear into the heart of law students everywhere because it's kind of confusing. So let me ask you first, what do you think it means? What is the rule against perpetuities?
Well, I probably wouldn't have any idea at all other than, like I say, I knew we did an episode before and it had to do with wills and leaving stuff, and there's certain requirements and how you leave stuff so that they can't go on in perpetuity. They have to be resolved in some manner under certain rules or something.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically it. I mean, if you break it down, rule against perpetuities, rule, we know what that means, that basically there's some sort of law or something you have to follow. Against, meaning it's going to forbid something.
It means it's not for.
Yeah, not for. And perpetuity, something that can go on forever, kind of like pie.
Like pie?
Yeah.
No, when you eat that pie, it's gone. And then you sit around wanting some more pie.
Not that pie, the numerical pie.
Pi r square.
There you go.
No, you've been taught wrong. Pi r round.
Pi r make you round. Pi r round. So essentially that's what it is. It's kind of a rule that keeps things going on forever. One definition I found online when I was trying to come up with a good definition for it, it said, a common law property rule that states no interest in land is good unless it must vest, if at all, not later than 21 years after some life and being at the creation of the interest. Because the meaning of this rule is virtually impossible to decipher, many states have modified it and some have abolished it altogether.
I was just going to say, to me, that sounds like a mishmash of words. If you'd asked me, now, what did I just tell you? I would have a hard time explaining the English words that you said to me, and English is my first language, and I still didn't understand it.
But, I mean, that's actually what that definition online on a legal dictionary said, that basically the rule is virtually impossible to decipher.
It is. I mean, even just listening to that, I would have no idea, even one of my haywire guesses, I wouldn't even know what to say.
Well, I went to Black's Dictionary, which is the bee's knees when it comes to legal definitions.
Legal definitions?
Yeah. And every law student, when you first go to law school, gets your own Black's Dictionary that you carry around with you and you look at. Well, you don't carry it around. It's a huge, heavy book. But it's good to look up all your different terms in. So mine is the 7th edition. And evidently we're on the 10th edition now, I just realized today. So I'm 3 editions behind.
I stick to Funkin' Wagnalls.
Funkin' Wagnalls?
Yeah.
Just for the joke?
Yeah, that's right. Because I'm a follower of Ronan Martin's Laugh-In.
Now, according to Black's Dictionary, the rule against perpetuities is defined as this. The rule prohibiting a grant of an estate unless the interest must vest, if at all, no later than 21 years after the death of some person alive when the interest was created.
All right. My first problem with that is must vest, if at all.
Right.
I don't understand that phrase.
Well, basically, when vest means...
It's not one of those things you wear with your suit.
It can be, but this is not in this context. It's not what it means.
All right.
Vest or to vest basically means a right or an interest in property, and it vests whenever it is secured. This means that the beneficiary of the right or property interest is certain to receive a specific amount either now or in the future. So basically, if I tell you I'm going to give you a piece of property at some time, at some point, that property hasn't vested in you yet.
But if you have to designate when that time is?
Or no, not even when the time is. It actually has to vest to you. It has to be a right you have. So basically, a lot of people talk about like matching contributions with their employers to 401ks. And they say that they'll match your contribution, but it doesn't vest until after a year or 2 years of employment. So basically that means you have to be there that 2 years in order to get your to get that matching contribution from them. That's when it vests.
Yeah, I do that with my employees. Yeah. I vest them. They have to be there a year before I give them any vacation.
Right.
I'm not going to give it to them up front and hope they stayed there the whole year.
Yeah, so exactly. So it's basically the same exact thing. They can't take vacation until it vests, right?
Right.
So
I don't call it that because I don't use them fancy words.
What do you call it? Pants?
You just have to be here.
You have to be here.
Show up.
The other part of that definition is lives in being. And this basically means individuals who are alive at the time of a particular conveyance of real property. So
we have that same rule. If you're dead, you don't get no vacation.
Get yourself a dirt nap. Now, there's some interesting quotes. There was also in the Black's Dictionary, and I've actually never seen quotes in the Black's Dictionary before. It's kind of funny. This was a quote that said, "Another scholar who spent a substantial part of an academic lifetime attempting to bring order and add sense to the rule against perpetuities, W. Barton Leach, described the rule as a technicality-ridden legal nightmare and a dangerous instrumentality in the hands of most members of the bar." Could you imagine spending the better part of your academic lifetime trying to decipher the rule against perpetuities?
Well, apparently, though, it's one of those things that even if you get your law degree, it's still hard to understand because they had to, what I saw, they had to eliminate the law where lawyers could be disbarred for not applying that properly in contracts because so many would do it and they weren't trying to. It was just a mistake that they made. So they had to kind of say, well, we can't penalize people. This is a hard rule to understand, and they're liable to make mistakes.
Well, in 1961, the Supreme Court of California ruled it was not legal malpractice for an attorney to draft a will that inadvertently violated the rule.
Yeah, there you go. That's what I came across,
yeah.
Because it was so hard that attorneys are likely to do that, and it's not because they were trying to get away with anything. It's just hard to understand.
Yeah, it is very difficult, and the language of it is pretty obtuse.
Yeah, it's hard to understand, too. I don't know what shape it is, but it's hard to understand.
Well, the best way to understand the rule against perpetuities is through some examples. And the examples to understand the rule against perpetuities have some, like, honestly very funny names. That's part of the reason why I like the rule against perpetuities, and I thought this would be a good topic. Not because I really love the rule against perpetuities, but I love the names of the examples.
So, this topic was picked on its entertainment factor more so than its legal factor, huh?
Maybe.
But if it's that hard to understand, then it is worth tackling anyway, even
That's
if it
true.
Does have entertainment value.
Yeah. I actually saw, according to Wikipedia, the rule against perpetuity is actually one of the most common topics for legal humorists. So people who talk about legal humor, they talk about the rule against perpetuities quite a bit. So
I'll have to get me one of those legal humorist books that they put out there with all those legal jokes.
Yeah, that's why my sport coats usually have elbow patches in them.
From wearing them out from leaning?
Yeah, for my humerus.
Oh, your humerus?
Get it?
I get it. Still wasn't funny, but I do get it.
But before I get to these examples, which are indeed funny, I think we have a couple of pending motions before the court today.
Well, if it please your perpetuity ship, I would like to approach the bench with some to pay court costs. It's been a while.
All right. Well, that's a mouthful.
Yeah.
Who do we have on the docket today? Who's our first motion?
Well, first up, as we approach the bench, is our friends back with us from Robinhood.
Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free.
They strive to make financial services work for everyone, not just the wealthy.
It's a non-intimidating way for stock market newcomers to invest for the first time with true confidence.
Simple and intuitive, clear design, with data presented in an easy-to-digest way.
Now, the nice thing about Robinhood is other brokerages can charge up to $10 for every trade, but Robinhood doesn't charge commission fees. Trade stocks and keep all of your profits.
Keep it all.
Don't pay any fees.
No, nobody likes fees.
That's right.
Design and ease of use. It is easy to understand charts and market data. Place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone. That's another great thing. You can do it on your phone. You don't even have to be at a computer somewhere.
And did you know that Robinhood web platform lets you view different stock collections, like the 100 most popular, sectors like entertainment or social media, and also curated categories like female CEOs? You also get analyst ratings of buy, hold, sell for every stock.
That is fantastic. And also, one of the great things, especially for somebody like me, is you can learn by doing. Learn how to invest as you build your portfolio. Discover new stocks and track favorite companies with personalized news feed and custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest.
And right now, Robinhood is giving listeners a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help build your portfolio.
Free!
Sign up at court.robinhood.com.
That's court.robinhood.com. And I'd be very interested to know if any of our listeners, because we've done Robinhood before, if any of them have signed up, and at what stock did they get? Apple, Ford, or Sprint? They all sound like good ones. So if you did, drop us a line and let us know.
That's right.
Now, next up is a brand new sponsor. One we haven't had before, but one we are both familiar with.
That's right, and I'm super excited to have them as a sponsor of the podcast.
And that is Audible.
Now, with Audible, you get access to unbeatable selection of audiobooks, including bestsellers, motivation, mysteries, thrillers, memoirs, and more.
Could listening make you a better parent, a better leader, even a better person? Could listening to motivating fitness programs get you fit? Could listening inspire you to start something new? There's never been a better time to start listening on Audible.
I use Audible quite a bit. I'm in the car a lot for work, and so I use Audible to listen to a lot of different audiobooks. Now, one book that I really enjoyed quite a bit that I listened to, this has actually been maybe over a year ago, was Dreamland. It's a talk about the opiate epidemic that's hitting America, and it was a really interesting read.
I've heard about that.
Yeah, and so I listened to that while I was driving along in my car, going from courthouse to courthouse, dealing with the ramifications of the different opiate crisis that was going on. And I'll tell you what, it gave me a lot of insight into my cases and my clients and things like that. You can learn a lot from listening to a book.
Well, Audible members can choose 3 titles every month, 1 audiobook and 2 Audible originals. You can't hear anywhere else. Audible members also get access to exclusive audio fitness programs to start the new year off on the right foot.
And you can listen on any device, anytime, anywhere. At home, at the gym, on your commute, or just on the go. You'll also enjoy easy audiobook exchanges, rollover credits, and an audiobook library you keep forever, even if you cancel.
Audible, the most inspiring minds, the most compelling stories. The best place to listen. Get started with a 30-day trial when you go to audible.com/appointed or text to 500-500 and listen for a change. So that's audible, audible.com/appointed, appointed.
Or you can text appointed to 500-500 and listen.
Just tell them that you're ready to listen for a change.
So, I teased you with some great examples before the break.
I can barely stand it. I'm at my teaser point.
Well, the first one is a example called the fertile octogenarian.
The fertile octogenarian?
What do you think that means?
It means it's a 80-something-year-old with kids?
80-year-old that can have kids, that can be pregnant.
The 80-year-old can be pregnant or impregnate?
Either way.
This is getting more. Now I feel even more teased.
The other one is called the unborn widow.
The unborn widow.
Yeah. And these are two different legal fictions that are often used to teach the rule against perpetuity. And kind of demonstrate the bizarre different things that can happen as a result of the rule.
So this is in the fiction section. It's not nonfiction.
Yeah, this isn't actually a case that that transpired. But basically, it's kind of to illustrate the issue with it. So, as I said, the Fertile Octogenarian is a fictitious character that comes up when you're applying the rule against perpetuities. The rule presumes that anyone, even an octogenarian, like you said, someone between 80 and 90 years of age, can parent a child regardless of sex or health. Suppose that a will devises a piece of land known as Blackacre. Now, we often talk about in law school and lawyers as Blackacre, Greenacre, Redacre, Yellowacre, Blueacre. All the property is named some sort of color named acre.
So, I've always heard that Green Acres is a place to be.
Yeah, farm living.
It's a life for me.
But this piece of property we're going to use in this example is called Blackacre. Blackacre is always the first piece of property you talk about.
Is that because of Black's Law?
Could be. So this will basically says, to A for her life, and then to the first of A's children to reach 25 years of age. A is, at that time, the will is probated, an 85-year-old woman. So basically you have A, 85-year-old woman, she's passed away. Her will says, first to her life, or the device says, first to her life, then to the first of her children to reach 25 years of age. So when you look at the rule of perpetuities as applied to this, some lawyer could argue, and the court, under the common law definition of it, had to accept that A could have a child in her 86th year, and then in the 87th year of all of A's other children could die. Then in her 88th year, A herself could die, because the interest will not vest until her new child reaches 25 years of age. So basically the problem is the vesting of the child's interest doesn't happen until they're 25 years of age. That becomes the real problem. And that cannot happen until more than 21 years after A or her other children have all died. Are you following me?
No, I'm lost.
So basically the rule against perpetuities makes the entire gift to the first of A's children to reach 25 years of age void. A will hold Blackacre for life, and then the property will revert to the person who transferred it to A in the first place. Because basically, the devise itself is invalid.
Well, so is it because that her youngest child isn't 25 when she dies?
Well, now I'm getting confused talking about it.
I know. I said I'm lost.
I'm not. It's not an exaggeration to say it's
what
confusing.
What if there were some already 25?
All right, so basically you say to A...
Maybe she didn't have any children.
There's a will devises a piece of land as Blackacre to A for her life, then to the first of A's children to reach 25 years of age.
Okay, but then we would have to assume she has no children if she has a child born when she's 86 and she's the first one this child is going to be the first one to reach 25. That means the other ones, there must not be any other ones.
Well, basically, if you look at the way the rule reads,
had to have been a surrogate.
The grant of an estate, unless the interest must vest, if at all, no later than 21 years after the death of some person alive when the interest was created. So, basically, if the first of A's children to reach 25 years of age, so subtract 21 years, that leaves you 4 years. So, basically, the problem with that devise is that she could have a child, and the interest will not vest within 21 years from the life and being.
Okay, so if she lived 5 years, she's covered.
Correct, and didn't have any other kids.
You're right. Yeah, 5 years after this child was born.
Right.
Yeah.
But the problem
is, it wouldn't matter if she had any more after that, because that one would reach 25 first, as long as they made it that far.
Right, but it doesn't matter, because the devise itself is actually in violation of the rule against perpetuities, because it's a possibility. Do you understand?
Well, it's a possibility anybody could die. You could be 30 and leave that, and you could die the next day. It doesn't matter if you're 85 or 86. That's any true. Of us can die at any time, Mike. There are no guarantees. Let me tell you, I don't know much about life, but I do know that there are no guarantees.
That's true.
I mean, I'm on borrowed time as it is.
The other kind of related thing to the fertile octogenarian, it goes in the other direction, which is known as the precocious toddler. So basically, the precocious toddler is a toddler who's fertile at a young age. So that can screw with the rule against perpetuities.
Oh,
as well.
That's just nasty. I don't even want to discuss that.
Well, no, but I mean,
toddlers having babies. What is this?
I don't want to discuss octogenarians having babies.
Legals? Well, that's bad enough. But if we get into toddler stuff, they've got laws against that.
Now the other one, the unborn widow, is also kind of a is
We never settled the last one. You know, you slipped right on off on that. We never really settled that.
No, I explained it.
Well, I'm more confused than when we started.
That's why lawyers get paid the big bucks. So, the unborn widow also has kind of a problem.
I'll never get that image out of my head now.
The unborn widow?
This 86-year-old woman having a baby.
Well, I mean, she could adopt a child, legally.
Well, yeah. I guess.
She's a very precocious fertile octogenarian. okay, so, the unborn widow. Suppose that a piece of property is left to A for life, then to his widow for life, then to A's issue. Because the gift to A's widow cannot be resolved until A dies, the law will consider it the possibility that, after the property is left to A, he marries a woman who was not born at the time the gift was made. For instance, it is possible that in 1950 the property is left to A, and in 1955 a woman B is born, and in 1975 A and B marry each other, neither having issue at the time. So it's possible that A will die, say in 1980, and his widow B will outlive him for more than 21 years, and that she dies in 2005. At that point, B was not a life in being at the time of the transfer, and the only remaining validating life under the rule against perpetuities is A, who has now been dead for 25 years by this time. To gift to A's issue does not vest until his widow dies, and since that could theoretically happen more than 21 years after the death of all lives in being at the time of the transfer to A's issue is invalid from the start.
Well, there's a lot of woulda, coulda, shouldas in there being considered. Isn't there some kind of rule that has it's like the wait and see rule?
The wait and see?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
Well, in other words, like, well, you know, there could be some problems with this, and if they were to arise, this would invalidate it, but maybe you'll be all right, so we'll just wait and see. But should this happen, then this will be invalid.
Well, the purpose of this rule is basically that English courts, and this all comes from common law, basically recognized early on that allowing owners to attach these different long-lasting contingencies to pieces of property was not a really a good thing, because you could tie up all this property and future generations wouldn't be able to freely buy and sell it. Also, it would be possible for kind of wealthy families to monopolize and tie up all kinds of land. Also, judges had concerns about the dead being able to impose excessive limitations on the ownership on those people that are still living. And that's kind of sometimes called the dead hand from the grave.
Well, that's a nice title.
Yeah, there's actually
the dead hand from the grave. I think I saw that movie.
There's also a Latin term called mortua manus.
Mortua manus.
Yeah.
Semper liberi.
That's right. So, but that's really the issue is that you don't want the dead hand from the grave controlling this property and not allowing the living people to transfer and devise it as they want. So when you have all these different weird contingencies that go on, and if this happens and then this happens and that happens, it really causes a legal nightmare. So, I mean, even though the rule is kind of complex and hard to understand, it actually does serve a legitimate purpose.
Well, what I was thinking about was it said that the United States has some differing approaches, and some states follow the wait and see or second look doctrine, or apply the Cypress doctrine. And under the wait and see approach, the validity of a suspect future interest is determined on the basis of facts as they now exist at the end of the measuring life and not at the time the interest was created. So in other words, that's what they're saying. Well, there might be some difficulties. Somebody might die before this happens. Somebody might be born before this will happen. But if you're willing to take that chance, then we'll let it stand and right. Then see what happens instead of just nullifying it right from the beginning. No, because you might die tomorrow and that won't count, or this might happen or something like that. Then they take the wait and see attitude on it. And those look like Latin words, Cypress, Cypress doctrine.
It's actually French. It's Cypras.
Cypras. Cypras doctrine.
And basically what it's supposed to mean is something that is near as possible to the testator's intentions, but it can't actually possibly be followed. So it's kind of realizing that there's a problem with it, but we're going to try to apply it and follow their intentions as close as we can.
Speaking of testators, that made me think. I saw a very interesting late-night show on John Wayne Bobbitt.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It was some really good insight into that that happened with interviews from people involved looking back at it 20 years ago.
Was there a testate tricks involved as well?
Oh, yeah. She turned some tricks, all right, with her knife.
So, do you understand kind of the theory of it?
Yeah. It's a little bit hard. There's other things besides just passing it on, too. There's things that can be implied, like it won't be passed on until a certain time, and as long as, like, there's no alcohol being sold on the property or something like that.
Right.
So
you have all these contingencies.
Yeah, you can put in those kind of contingencies. And that way, then, if it is, then it reverts back to whoever or passes to somebody else.
Right. But if you put something in there that says, to any of my grandchildren who attain the age of 25 without having drank any alcohol, I mean, that's probably going to be a problem against the rule against perpetuities because
it's going to be hard to prove.
Well, number one, it's going to be hard to prove. But number two, it's going to not vest within 21 years from the life and the time of being. So,
or it vests right at 21 years. You have to be 21 years of age to legally do it. Did it? No, it didn't say legally.
It just said period.
I tell you what, I'd be a five-year-old not taking a swig. Yeah, you better not.
You'd be a very precocious toddler doing that.
But once you got it, boy, it's party time. Once you got control of the property, it's mine, baby. Bring in the booze.
So, you know, obviously these different examples they use to illustrate the rule against perpetuities probably never happened. But there are possibilities out there, and that's why you use them to kind of illustrate the rule itself and try to get a better grasp on it. Some of the other examples that we're not going to get into, but just the names are pretty good. The slothful executor.
The slothful executor?
Yeah, a situation where the executor of an estate does not probate the will for many years after the testator's death.
Oh, it doesn't have anything to do with the girl on The Bachelor the other night there, sloth girl?
No, I don't know what you're talking about. The magic gravel pit. A transfer to be made as soon as the gravel pit is out of gravel may not vest for 100 or so years. So basically, you know, it doesn't happen until all the gravel's gone. That doesn't work because you don't know when that's going to be.
Is that where Fred works?
That's right.
Fred and Barney?
Or the war that never ends. Basically, a transfer to be made at the end of a war, which the war may never end, so it could keep on going forever.
Yeah, there was one war that was a 100 years war.
Yeah.
That would have been violating the 21, huh?
Sure would have been.
Almost five times.
But like you said, pretty much the rule against perpetuities is gone, I believe, in all state jurisdictions. And as you said, in the U.S., some different places have adopted the wait and see type situation. Some people have, some different jurisdictions have basically said the woman's presumed to be no longer fertile at a certain age. And there's just different ways they've kind of gone around getting out of the rule against perpetuities. But you still learn about it in law school. It still makes you scratch your head. You probably don't understand it now, even though I tried to explain it to you. I probably don't understand it as I just explained it to you. And looking from the look on your face, I'm pretty sure you don't understand what I just said.
Well, I would not want to attempt to write something and know whether it was correct or not based on what knowledge I've heard from it.
I know it sounds kind of simplistic. But if you go back to the actual definition, the rule prohibits a grant of an estate unless the interest must vest, if at all, no later than 21 years after the death of some person alive when the interest was created. So anytime you go out and you're talking about a class of people that is not really defined, that they could not be born yet, that's going to be a red flag and a problem. And also if you have some other kind of weird contingency in there that it doesn't happen until a certain event occurs and it gives a specific time in the future, that's going to be another kind of red flag. Like, wait a second, this may be a problem.
Well, I would guess that the most common use of this is when, like, a grandfather is leaving in his will to his grandchildren money and saying, but it's not until they, like, reach the age of 21 or 25, just because you don't want to leave a five-year-old several million dollars because somebody else is going to be controlling that. So, and you may want them to get through school.
Well, that's true.
Or something like that before they're, you want them to be adults before they're managing their fortune or property or whatever.
In that situation, I mean, you would want to set up a trust for the child. Mm-hmm. And you have to have somebody who you can literally trust to administer that for the child.
I mean, thus the name.
Thus the name. That's what I always tell people whenever I'm setting up trust for them. They're like, I want to do a trust. It's like, well, do you have someone you can trust? Because a trust is only as good as someone you trust. That's a lot. That's using the word trust quite a bit there.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's very true because...
trust me.
Yeah, trust me. Because you want to make sure you have somebody who's not going to break their fiduciary duty.
Ooh, you break your fiduciary, you're in trouble.
That's right. Now, there was one gentleman that we talked about before, a man by the name of Willington R. Burt.
Willington R. Burt.
He was born in 1831, and he died in 1919, and he was a lumber baron from Saginaw, Michigan.
A lumber baron.
When he passed away, his wealth was estimated to be between $40 and $90 million, so quite substantial.
That's a lot of lumber.
It is. He is most well known, though, for having a very strange will, and it contained what is known as a spite clause now, and basically, he wrote this in his will as part of a family feud. And it specified to wait 21 years after his children and grandchildren were dead before the bulk of his fortune could go to any descendants. So basically, in effect, it alienated his children and his grandchildren from the estate, but they got some sort of kind of small annuities from it. And the conditions of the mill were actually met, of the will, not mill, lumber baron.
Lumber mill.
The conditions of the
will. That's what I thought you were talking about, the mill.
No, the conditions of the will were met in 2010. After the 1989 death of the last grandchild. And in May of 2011, 12 of his descendants finally received the estate worth about $100 million. So basically, he wrote this will to...
So that none of his kids or grandkids would get any money. He hated them all so bad.
And, yeah, and to not violate the rule against perpetuities. So he had a lawyer who was smart enough to do that.
Yeah, and so the great-grandchildren benefited from it.
Yeah, yeah. That's pretty crazy. And that, you know, this guy, he's kind of remembered as this this old, like, spiteful old guy. He's like, I'll show those young whippersnappers. I'll write them out of my will. But he actually was kind of a very altruistic person who gave a lot and was, like, the mayor of the town and things like that. So maybe his kids were rotten. I don't know.
When they sat around to read the will and all the family sitting around rubbing their hands together, waiting to see what they got, he probably said, lawyer said, well, here's a tape that he left for you. And they turned that on, and the hairy old guy was probably just sitting there going, ah!
And then
that was it. He didn't say anything.
Then they had to contact Richard Pryor, and he came in and he got all the money, but he had to spend it really quickly.
There was one other thing that I saw about these that I might have misunderstood it, but it, you know, you can't leave like a specification in a will. I'm leaving this money to John. Should he not be alive, then I'll leave it to, you know, Bill. You can't specify it in that manner, but you can if you're leaving the money to charity. You can specify that you're leaving so much of your fortune or whatever, all of it, whatever it is, to a certain charity. But if that charity no longer exists at the time, then here's another charity that you can do it.
Well, you can leave something. You can have a contingency. So I could say in my will that I leave everything to Thomas Smurl, but should Thomas Smurl predecease me, I leave everything to Riley Smurl. So, I mean, I could put that in a will, and that's not a problem. You can say that.
Well, there was something in there that I read that made charities specific to something you could do that you can't do with private individuals, that you can make it so that it can go to a different charity if something happens, or like, say, they don't have a local branch here anymore, then I want it left to this charity.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there is some sort of exception.
Or maybe it's stipulations you can put on it or something like that.
The rule against perpetuities may not apply to charities. I don't really know. I've never had that pop up.
Well, perhaps you should do some digging or put that on a law test for somebody to really mess them up.
I'll put that on my to-do list.
Okay. With all your lawyerly things.
Now, the rule against perpetuities, aside from haunting law students and lawyers and being on tests and things like that, actually has been a plot device in different movies. In 1981, the film Body Heat... the rule against
perpetuities. I remember that movie.
I don't really remember that movie.
I do. That was Kathleen Turner and William Hurt's big debut.
Mm.
And she was considered hot back then.
But basically, that the rule against perpetuities was one of the main plot points of that. And also, there was some sort of secondary plot line in the 2011 movie, The Descendants.
Which, was that George Clooney movie?
It was. I never saw it, but it looked good.
I saw it, and I remember seeing it. I saw both of them. I saw Body Heat and The Descendants. Body Heat, I just remember the sex scenes. I don't really remember the plot. And The Descendants, I don't remember what happened there. I know it had something to do with the wife and property, and I think she died, and he was left with his daughters, and something happened. But I don't remember what it was. I guess I have to watch that movie again. I know I enjoyed the movie.
There's your homework for the week.
Yep. Well, that's not too bad a homework, have to watch a George Clooney movie.
No.
I like George Clooney.
He's a good actor.
He's also a big prankster.
Is he?
People that do movies with him talk about how he's always pulling pranks on people and goofing on people and stuff like that. He's supposed to be a fun guy to work with.
I like to know that.
There you go.
I always thought George Clooney would be kind of a cool guy.
Yeah, he's a cool guy. He hangs out with his buddies. They pull pranks on each other. Here was one that is a famous actual example of an exception. This was, I think, the one that had to do with the charities. It applies to Harvard's Widener Library. Eleanor Elkins Widener, the library's benefactor, stipulated that no additions or alterations could be made to the facade of the building. If the university ever changes a facade, it loses the building to the Boston Public Library. Because both Harvard and the Boston Public Library are charities, the restriction can apply indefinitely.
Huh.
So she built them that library. So if you ever change the front of it, then it goes to the Boston Library. They get the building on your campus.
Right. So, yeah, that would basically mean that the rule against perpetuities doesn't apply to charities.
Right. Yeah, that's what...
They go on. They actually go on into perpetuity.
Whereas you couldn't do that to say, if they do that, then it reverts to John so-and-so or something like that. You can't leave it to another person. You can just do it from charity to charity.
Yeah, so if you want to use the dead hand to control from the grave, give it to a charity.
Yeah, there you go.
That'll show them.
That'll show those charities. Now, so they're stuck with this old building now. They can't do anything with it because she left that in there, the old bat.
All right, well, that's going to bring us to...
Legal briefs.
So Legal Briefs is the part of the show where we go over different legal terms. And this episode is chock full of them.
Chock full of nuts.
So, in your own words...
Oh, my.
Tell me, what is the rule against perpetuities?
The rule against perpetuities prohibits someone from leaving something in perpetuity. It must be designated to go to someone within certain constraints, which usually designates 21 years and is vested.
Well, I think you hit all the sides there.
I said all the words. I just didn't say them in right order.
Yeah. You jumble that around a little bit.
Yeah, a lot.
It's a rule prohibiting a grant of an estate unless the interest must vest, if at all, no later than 21 years after the death of some person alive when the interest was created.
Which made no more sense than what I said. It's just correct, and I'm not.
So what does vest mean?
Vest means it takes place. I mean, it happens. You have to have accomplished some certain amount of time or being there or something to actually be vested.
It's when an interest is secured, when it becomes yours.
Right.
That's when something
vests. Because you were there and long enough or something.
Sort of, yes. Now, I'm going to list you different terms and different examples that we use to demonstrate the rule against perpetuities. And you're going to say either true or false if it's one that people use to illustrate the rule against perpetuities.
Okay. True.
All right. So
I feel like we're playing Who Wants to Be a Millionaire?
Is this your final answer?
It's my final answer.
So, true or false? The fertile octogenarian.
True.
That's right.
Who could forget that?
I know. The tenacious T-set.
The tenacious D?
T-set.
No. The tenacious D-set. That would be a good one.
Now, these might not be ones we mentioned. I mean, these could be other ones.
I'm going to say no. False.
Correct. That's false. The Dastardly Debutante.
False.
Ooh, that is false. I thought that was a good one, though. The Unborn Widow.
True.
The Flying Walk.
False. The Flying Walk. If it hits you in the head, you'll get charged with something else.
The Precocious Toddler.
True. You're not counting them. Was I correct?
That's correct.
I need all the corrects I can get.
I'm checking my list here. My key's a little off.
You checking your list? Checking it twice?
The Empty Lake.
False.
I don't know. You sure?
False. Final answer.
To a gift, I give Blackacre to A until the lake shall be empty. And then upon the lake being empty, then it shall go to B.
No, that would violate the law of perpetuity.
So it'd be a good example then, wouldn't it?
So the gravel pit, though. It was a gravel pit when it wasn't a lake. You changed it.
Same theory.
No,
you're
not.
You're right. No one's had the empty lake except me.
Yeah, that's right. You tried to get me on a technicality. You tried to change a name and the circumstances and the minerals.
It's all about the minerals.
That's right.
Well, of course I had to do that. I mean, that's what lawyers do, right?
Yeah, they try to trip you up.
You actually nailed all the true and false. That's really good.
Well, I'm pretty good when I got a 50-50 chance.
Now, let me ask you a question. It's not a true or false, it's a question. If I had a legal term or a legal issue and I needed to get a definition for it, where would I go?
Well, I would go to the Funk and Wagnalls. You would go to Black's Law Dictionary.
And what edition would I go to at my desk?
The most current one. That's in your desk.
I have the 7th edition.
That's in your desk.
That's right.
See, I said it right. It's the most current one that's in your desk.
You're trying to lawyer me.
Lawyer up.
Just out of curiosity, I was wondering, like, if there is a first edition Black's Law Dictionary out there. I saw one online. It was like $2,500.
Man.
Yeah, it was like falling apart. They'd look pretty cool on my bookshelf, though.
Well, they ought to keep them in good condition, like baseball cards or something. They're worth more if they're in good condition. If they're falling apart, they're not worth a whole lot.
Yeah, except during the 30s editions for the Black's Law Dictionary. That was the steroid era.
Oh, but you know what? I don't know if you'd want a lawyer that had a good, pristine Black's Law book.
No, probably not.
That means they hadn't been looking at it much.
No, every time I actually look a term up, I highlight it. Because I figure if I looked it up once, I'll probably have to look it up again.
Well, that's probably true.
You know, that was like a life pro tip that somebody told me about phone books before, too. That if you look somebody's name up in a phone book, go ahead and highlight it. Because if you looked it up once, chances are you're going to look it up again.
Well, I bet they didn't count on the perpetuity of phone books going out the window.
No. Neither did the yellow book salesman that comes to my office that tries to sell me those things.
I still get that too. They're telling me they're going to cancel my ad in the yellow pages if I don't pay it. I'm like, cancel it. I never paid you for one anyway.
Go ahead. Do your worst.
Go ahead. If anybody's looking in the yellow pages, they do not want data warehousing or digital imaging because they're looking in a phone book. They probably want teletype or something.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well then, not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out though, right?
Usually. Good. This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Sprung. And I'm just a dude.